Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Welcome, everybody, to Parsha class for Parshas Vayigash, 5773. Last week was our siyum for the 48 Ways to Wisdom with Rav Noach Weinberg. And you're probably wondering what we're going to do now. Well, I'm going to tell you in a minute. Okay? Now, I gave a lot of thought, and I really, it was only the last day or two that things started to come together. I was thinking about Rav Noach Weinberg, and what would he say if I were to ask him how to present the Parsha? And I was thinking about some of the things that we learned from him, and if I could just excerpt a little bit, just to follow my thought process a little bit. Way number 14, I hope to really come back and always to these lessons, because they're so important. But in way number 14, about introducing the whole topic of the Torah, the written instructions for living. Imagine you received a message from outer space. You might not fully understand its meaning, but you are fascinated. You will study every word and try to decode it. Torah is the word of God communicated to the Jewish people at Mount Sinai. If a piece of Torah doesn't seem to make sense, don't pass it off as irrelevant. Keep asking, searching, delving. Look deeper into what each piece of Torah is telling you. All the stories and commandments are really philosophical messages waiting to be revealed by the intellectually active mind. The flood, the Tower of Babel, the splitting of the Red Sea, all contain the deepest wisdom for living. Even dates, names, numbers, events, and lineage all teach us something. The message is often between the lines, and when the message seems obvious, there's more below the surface. It's tragic that we learned the Torah, this has been said by rabbis before, like we were when we were five, you know, Bible stories, and we just keep on repeating the same Bible stories until we're 95. But really, we have to mature in our approach to Torah. So I know that Rav Noach would say that. And I know that Rav Noach would say, as he did in way 44, to analyze the issues. You have to analyze. You have to ask questions. Don't just take what you read and assume that you understand it. Ask questions. Challenge it with the assumptions that you have going in. Why does this seem strange to me? Why does it seem to contradict some things that I know to be true? And I know that Rav Noach would say, expand your ideas. When you learn a piece of wisdom, extract what's relevant to your life. Develop it and take it to its ultimate conclusions. Live with it. All right? So I think that Rav Noach would say, you've got to study the Torah. You've got so much to choose from, which is the hard part. How do you know what to focus on? You have to analyze it, you have to question it, and you have to take out of it the messages that are relevant and meaningful to your life. And I checked the reality of this approach when I met with my good friend Alan Smirin. We meet every other week, and he doesn't live in this neighborhood, but he knew that I was looking for an approach, and he basically said the same thing. He said that when a secular Jew that has some idea that the Torah is our instructions, that they want to know, what instructions am I hearing from this story? And so I said, you know, Alan, I think we're thinking on the same wavelength. So that's a major challenge for me every week to try to find something to focus on, to narrow it down, and to analyze it and to figure out what is the Torah telling us that would be a meaningful message for anyone. It shouldn't be something that's, you know, that's a very interesting point according to Nachmanides' approach. It's got to be something something that anybody would say, that is an instruction for living. So it's a big challenge. I was just sitting last night at 10:30 with my daughter, who's in Tamima, and I was helping her with her homework, and I said to her, and I've got homework too, because I don't know what I'm going to speak about at my Parsha class. And I started talking to her, and as I was talking, it became clear. So Hashem is helping, and I know that He will, because we're all doing this for the right reasons. So, here goes. The story that I wanted to focus on is the encounter, the dialogue, really the monologue, between Yehuda and Yosef at the beginning of the Parsha Vayigash. It's really a monologue. Yosef has previously framed Binyamin by planting the goblet in his sack and has now said that Binyamin is to remain here as my servant and the rest of you can go home. And that has inspired Yehuda to step forward and do something about it. So, as we read the first page or so in the Chumash, Yehuda says a lot of things. And he is repeating a lot of the facts that we know already from the story. I was trying to discern the tone of voice of Yehuda. Is Yehuda approaching Yosef respectfully? Or is Yehuda approaching Yosef with strength and with accusation? And it's really, if you read, look at the commentators, it's really not so clear. It's really not so clear. Let's just read some of it, just to get a flavor how it's really not so clear. Then Judah approached him and said, "If you please, my lord, may your servant speak a word in my lord's ears, and let not your anger flare up at your servant, for you are like Pharaoh." Sounds very, very respectful and self-effacing. "My lord has asked his servant, saying, 'Have you a father or brother?' And we said to my lord, 'We have an old father and a young child of his old age. His brother is dead. He alone is left from his mother, and his father loves him.'" And he goes on in the same vein. Ramban, he says that Yehuda is just trying to appeal to Yosef's compassion. And Yosef, in fact, said to the brothers back in Miketz, "Es ho Elokim ani yorei, I'm a God-fearing person." So Yehuda feels that he can speak to a God-fearing person in a way that arouses compassion. Rashi, on the other hand, Rashi introduces words of accusation from Yehuda's mouth. For example, I didn't bring the Rashi translation, but here, some of it is quoted in the Art Scroll. The Midrash interprets the inner connotation of the phrase when he says, "For you are like Pharaoh," to imply, "You will be smitten with leprosy for detaining Benjamin, just as an earlier Pharaoh was smitten for detaining his great-grandmother, Sarah, for only one night." So it's like a threat. Another Midrashic interpretation, "You are like Pharaoh in that neither of you keeps promises. You said you wanted to set eyes on him. Is this what you call setting eyes on someone?" So he's pointing out, you know, you are not following your promises. You're inconsistent. If you look at the Midrash, it makes it even worse. It makes Yehuda be extremely fierce and biting. It has dialogues that you know, make your eyes turn. In fact, Yehuda and Yosef was retorting. Listen to this. This is from the Midrash. At one point, you know, Yehuda says that, "How can we go back without our brother? What will happen to our father? It will happen that when he sees the youth is missing, he will die, and your servants will have brought down the hoariness of your servant, our father, in sorrow to the grave. We can't do this to him." According to the Midrash, Yosef says, "Why did you not consider your father's pain when you sold your other brother for 20 silver pieces. Look who's being inconsistent there. Look at you. Hypocrite. And that made Yehuda cry, according to this, and then he started threatening Yosef. He said, I have only to draw my sword from its sheath to fill Egypt with slain bodies. This is according to the Midrash, what Yehuda is saying. Yosef answered, if you draw your sword, I will tie it to your own neck. I will open my mouth wide to swallow you, says Judah. I shall stuff your mouth with a stone, says Joseph. And I think there's a point, Yosef says, oh, are you going to do to Egypt what you did to Shechem?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this one little page can be interpreted in many different stripes, either very respectful or very fierce and vindictive. Yeah.
Okay, so you're saying it's kind of like a Tom Stoppard or a Pinter play. They're talking respectfully on the surface, but everything is a coded message that the other one gets.
Right.
But how would Yehuda give an allusion to Yosef that you're holding him in Egypt like the other Paro who held Sarah, when at the time he doesn't know that Yosef is Yosef, that Yosef's Jewish?
Right.
There's a whole back and forth.
Yeah. It seems Yosef, like they know who the other one is.
Saying, right. And Yosef, yeah, they know who the other one is, and Yosef's saying like, oh, I see you're a strong military person. You could take out Egypt like Shechem.
Mm-hmm.
But how would he know? How would he know such a thing?
Okay. So this is where I'm going to remember Rav Noach's words, and he says, what's the lessons for living? In other words, I don't know the answer to everything. It's very good, and we'd have to really get to the bottom of this. We'd have to dig deeper.
Okay.
And I didn't go that far, but I went as far as I needed to go to learn what I think is a very important lesson that everybody, no matter what level they were on, would consider to be an important lesson. And that is regarding the nature of clashes between people. So you pointed out very well, Jennifer, on the surface they're talking nicely to each other, but beneath the surface they are at each other's throats. And tell me if you agree. When people see things differently, they have a long list of complaints and claims and inconsistencies that the other person is guilty of. Is that right? They could go on a diatribe about all the things that the other person did to hurt them, that they did not meet expectations, that they promised one thing and delivered another. And we are so clear on all those things against the other person, right? When two people get into an argument like that and the claims start flying, does that bring them closer to resolution? Not at all. It just makes it flare more. How did this story end? How was this conflict? And I'm not even going into the philosophical issues of what the conflict was about. I mean, that is a topic that we could talk about for days and weeks. But how did this conflict get settled? According to the commentaries, and I think there's a midrash that supports this very strongly, the resolution came about in this very dialogue, this very statement by Yehuda. When Yehuda said, in verse 32, Ki avdecha arav es hana'ar me'im avi lemor. Your servant, that means me, Yehuda, took responsibility for the youth from my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I will have sinned to my father for all time. In fact, my brother, Rav Chaim, that's what he spoke about last time. The Midrash says that when Yehuda said those words, he appeased Yosef, he appeased his brothers, and he appeased Binyamin, the youngest. He appeased Yosef because Yosef had been the victim of hatred. And the primary reason that he was the victim of hatred was because Yosef was the son of Rachel. And the sons of Leah were against the sons of Rachel. It was a clash. And when Yehuda steps forward and says, I will take responsibility, or I did take responsibility for Binyamin, who is the son of Rachel, Yosef says, Yehuda really does love us and take care of us. So that repaired the Yosef thing. The brothers had a complaint against Yehuda for suggesting that they sell Yosef in the first place. They were thinking, you know, Yehuda's the strongest of the brothers, and whatever he says, we do. But he shouldn't have done that. And they had this against him all these years. And when they saw Yehuda taking responsibility for Binyamin, they too forgave him. And Binyamin himself had this, if he had heard the story, he had this complaint against Yehuda for selling his one and only brother. So when he took responsibility for Binyamin, Binyamin forgave him. So really, however you interpret the clash, what the clash was about, it came to resolution when Yehuda decided to take responsibility for his own actions. And he put aside all of the words, all of the complaints, and all of the inconsistencies of Yosef, and he just says, I'm taking responsibility. And right after that, the Torah says Yosef could not restrain himself anymore. Yosef had a plan also to bring resolution to this family. And he had this whole thing with his dreams and how he was going to bring all the brothers to bow to him, and then he was going to somehow end this thing. But he says, it's over. Yehuda just ended it. I don't have to wait anymore. It is resolved. Because Yehuda just took responsibility, I am now going to take responsibility, and I'm going to be the loving brother that I am. Somebody expresses it so beautifully, that the art scroll, Bracious. It was a confrontation that ended with all the brothers acknowledging that Joseph was their king, at least for that period of Jewish history. How magnificently regal Judah proved himself to be in those tense moments. Judah succeeded so well in breaking down Joseph's resistance that Joseph could not restrain himself. Joseph wanted to restrain himself, but he could not. Judah had stripped away his harsh exterior and exposed him as a loving brother and son. In other words, when one of those two brothers stepped up and said, I'm taking responsibility for this conflict, that is how conflict is ended. That is the lesson that everybody can take home. That, you know, usually the list of complaints and inconsistencies were probably right. Because everybody is inconsistent and everybody has faults and failings. We all do. Pointing them out to the other person is not going to end the problem. It's just going to exacerbate it. The only way to resolve conflict and to bring out the love and the admiration in a relationship is for somebody to say, I'm going to take responsibility. And they hold the key to that relationship in their hand. That's a lesson, a take-home lesson that I learned from this story. And that's all I have to say, but I'd love to have additional discussion. Yes, Farda.
The first thing, and we're instructed at some point that the Torah has a tendency to mock certain things. The laughter, Sarah, and the laughter, that there could be certain nuances that are expressed in a particular way that aren't really as they are presented, that perhaps they are the reverse, but they are presented in a way, in a more positive light in this instance.
Okay. All right, so when I read and study and I look at sisters, I see where there is something that resembles. And when I look at brothers, I see something in regards to partnership. So if we look at three brothers, and pertaining to what you just shared with us, that from my perspective, that it's not about the other person. It's about how grounded and how strong a footing I have when I'm making a certain presentation or mm-hmm. I'm in the presence of someone mm-hmm. else. And mm-hmm. taking this to the bigger picture,
mm-hmm.
that the Jewish people, Yehuda, Yehudim, have the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
So we already, the tree is so deeply rooted
mm-hmm.
that we're already in that posture. We don't have to go out into the world and attack or belittle mm-hmm. or make anybody else look less
mm-hmm.
because we know who we are, we know what we have.
Very nice.
Shabbat.
Who are the three brothers in partnership?
I won't go into it too deeply, but if you want to look at it this way, look at the Arab nations, look at the Jewish people, and look at the Gentile world.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. 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 One story that I recalled, I'm sure I've shared it in this class before, but the brother of Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, Rav Aaron Feldman, from Baltimore, and formerly from Eretz Yisrael, formerly from Baltimore before that. But anyway, he was once approached by a couple to help them with some marital counseling. And this was a very, very religious and knowledgeable couple. Both of them were extremely educated and knew all the sources. And they wanted to present the issue based on Torah sources. So the husband had a passage open where it described all of the responsibilities of a Jewish wife towards her husband. And the wife had the exact same thing for his responsibilities. And after hearing them out, the rabbi said, I've got a very simple solution. And he says, here, let me take the sources. And he switched them around. He said, that's your problem. You're thinking about what he needs to do, and you're thinking about what she needs to do. If each of you would just follow what you're supposed to do, you will have harmony. It's easier said than done, but it's so powerful to me that Yosef, who had built up this, you know, this independence, and he was like, for all intents and purposes, he was on his own. He didn't have any brothers anymore. And this idea of he couldn't withhold his brotherly love came forward when he heard Yehuda saying how he felt so responsible for Binyamin. And that was like total shift from the way it was, you know, the years ago. You see how one person can affect another and bring out the best in another just by being that, you know, that man to step forward and say, okay, I'll take responsibility. Regardless of whether my complaints are against you are valid, we all have faults. All of our complaints, let's assume, are valid. But I'm going to take responsibility to make peace, to make shalom. That's such a powerful thing, and it brings out the best in both sides. So
it seems that what comes out from this, though, is that Yehuda ends up being the leader of the family rather than Yosef. Yosef is controlling the whole situation.
Right.
Egypt.
Right.
It was,
right.
Really has stepped up.
That's very true, and that explains a lot. I mean, that explains historically. You know, Yosef was the man of the hour, but Yehuda was the man of the eternity.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe, you know, they maybe back then they underestimated the importance of Yosef and what his abilities were and how vital his contribution would be for the Jewish people down the road, and because he was, you know, a different kind. He was flashy. He was worldly, and they maybe that was part of the problem, is that they criticized him and they didn't see the value of his contribution. At this point, however, they did. They realized, my goodness, this one man is keeping the whole world eating, and so they had to turn around. And Yehuda realized that we sold him short. and that coming around, and it just, you know, brought out the best of everybody. Indeed, our tradition says that before the Mashiach comes, and that Mashiach is, of course, a descendant of David, and David comes from the tribe of Yehuda, there is going to be a Mashiach from Yosef's tribe. This is the tradition. There will be a Mashiach ben Yosef, and that will be followed by Mashiach ben David. So, these two brothers, each one is a king, and each one needs to be reckoned with. But the way that it's resolved is just breathtaking, and I think that this is a lesson that everyone will agree is something, you know, relevant, meaningful, and something that we can take with us. Yes.
Okay, so two questions. Mordechai is from which tribe?
Mordechai is from Binyamin.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
Ish Yamini from Yamin. Binyamin.
Right. Ish Yamini, like he's straight.
Yeah.
And he's from Binyamin.
Yeah.
So then I was in Beit HaTfutzot this time when I was in Israel, you know, like the Museum of Jewish Heritage, and it goes through Jews in medieval Europe. So mm-hmm. Do you want to point to like one, can you think of like one specific court Jew? There were always Jews in the courts of Europe, and mm-hmm. they had to be very honest, they had to be very learned, and they held, you know, tremendous power that...
In the secular government, you mean?
In the secular government.
Right, like a Barbanel in Spain. Was one like that, and like someone like that, you mean?
Yeah, somebody like.
And in earlier times, you know, Daniel was the chief advisor to to the Babylonian king, and then the Persian king, and
Rambam.
What? Rambam was a physician of the Sultan. Rambam. Yeah, right, Maimonides.
Daniel's from which tribe?
Daniel, that's a good question. Job, he was an advisor to Pharaoh, according to
Job
the
Talmud. Job was an advisor to Pharaoh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's right, Job. That was a hard Job.
Yitro was also.
Yeah, but he wasn't Jewish. But in terms of a Jewish statesman like that.
I know Shmuel is Shmuel HaNagid.
Mm-hmm. Shmuel HaNagid, yeah.
Who's
Shmuel
HaNagid?
He was the sort of Spanish Umayyad. He was the like the assistant to the caliph.
Uh-huh.
He ran the government.
Uh-huh.
He ran the government. And but you know, when the Muslims came to Spain, they always put the Jews in control, because they are, rather than put out, well, that's enough, a long story.
Yeah.
But they always put the Jews in control, because they could never rise to threaten the government, because they were a minority.
Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was also very, very close with the Caesar, Antonius. For sure, Jews have been influential in government throughout the generations.
But there's because they're honest there's and trustworthy. There's a difference between using your power to feather your own nest, to make a nice bank account,
right,
to try to get an advantage
right.
for your family, and being scrupulously honest.
Mm-hmm.
Paro had to trust Yosef with everything. The situation, you know, was going to be in big crisis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So your midrash, in a simple way, the midrash of them saying, eat the dish, and I'll take, put the
yeah.
This is a growth thing. It sounds like when they were kids.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
He had game and we'll go
back. Right.
That's the same with...
Yeah. Back to the old...
Now they grew up finally, and they're taking responsibility for
it. Right. I did see explanation of the Medrash that when he keeps on saying, I'll take your sword and wrap it around your neck, I'll take the stone and put it in your mouth, that what they're saying to each other is, you know, whatever you say to me, whatever claim you have against me, I could turn it around and show you that you're guilty also. It's this kind of, you know, and usually when we're fighting, we're usually right, you know, like nobody is blameless, and that's kind of how they're arguing.
But the way to make peace in an argument is to start by taking responsibility.
Yeah, that's
upon
right.
Yourself.
That's right.
Not saying you think I'm bad,
right.
You're worse.
Right, 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 right.
You have.
Right. Look who's talking. Yeah. That's how kids.
Say,
that's how kids fight.
You know, the best thing to do is to say, "It's my fault."
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And then don't say any more.
Right.
You know. And I like that approach. You know. That's.
And then you ruin it by at the end, and you say, "Well, at least I was mad enough to admit it." What about you?
Why
didn't you take responsibility?
Okay. Well, I like the story about David on the roof. You know, when he says. You know, when Nathan comes to him and says, "Look, you know, you're a bad guy."
Yeah.
What did David say?
"I have sinned."
"I have sinned." And
he
didn't
yeah.
say, "Well, you know, Bathsheba was tempting me by
right,
parading
right,
around naked
right.
and all that stuff." No, he didn't say that. He said, "I have sinned before God."
And that was, I think, that was what the comment why Saul lost the kingship was because when he was accosted by the prophet for not killing Amalek, he had a justification.
Yeah.
He had some excuse,
yeah.
And the prophet says, "No, a leader does not give excuses.
Yes.
A leader takes responsibility." Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
If you have any given week, if you have some questions or some topics in the parsha that you would like to us to delve into, I will definitely be receptive, because we're looking for. You know, there's something that we can...
What's the mitzvah of the parsha?
This one?
Yeah.
By gosh? You mean implicit, not explicit?
Yeah.
Something with honoring parents? What is it? Or
I don't know. Isn't there a special sefer that goes into...
Oh, yeah, but it doesn't have... Most of the parshas of Bereishis do not have mitzvahs. You only have three in the whole book of Bereishis. You've got the having children... Which God said to Adam and Eve, you have Mila, priest Mila, and you have not even Shabbos. You have not to eat from the sciatic nerve, based on a verse in Bereishis. And then the next mitzvah is in Bo, which is part of Shemos. So Bereishis is not about the formal mitzvahs, but it's certainly about how to live.
Rabbi Kellerman says that Rabbi Yeruchim says that there's Torah im Derech Eretz. Bereishis is all about the laws of Derech Eretz.
Proper conduct. And that has to come before we can start getting mitzvahs. Very good. Heshkoch. Yes, Lenore?
Just a question. Is there such a mitzvah as create peace, not war?
Oh.
Because that's what he did. He...
Yeah.
They created peace instead of allowing war to or fighting. Is that a mitzvah?
Is it a mitzvah to make peace? I would say one of the greatest ones. Hava'as shalom bein adam l'chaveiro. It's one of the precepts, and according to the Talmud, that one. Pursue peace, love peace, pursue peace. I'm sorry, Varda. Did you have something else that you wanted to say?
Well, I didn't really raise my hand or anything, but as long as you say. I noticed in the last 24 hours in my studying that every mitzvah that I come across, I see the relationship that of it going back to Mitzrayim, that it was something that we had to have experienced on some level in Mitzrayim, that... it's been quite an eye-opener for me.
Wow.
Yeah. I see a connection there.
Well, when we get back together again, please God, in 2 weeks, we will be at the threshold of the Exodus from Mitzrayim.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.